Hi everybody, I'm Louise Aker, I'm one of the programming team here at Docs Ireland. I just wanted to welcome you all to this panel on the art of activism and the crossover between, I suppose, like the Venn diagram of documentary, artistry and activism as often is involved in documentary film. So we've got a really amazing panel for this discussion today. Four women and women who work in different fields. So I will pass it over to Ola, and he will introduce everybody. Welcome.
Thank you, Rose, and welcome all to Art of Activism here at the Belfast Film Festival. It's really great to be here. Thank you so much to Rose for the invite. And here our panel is Tressa O'Brien, Anna Rogers, and Gillian Callan, and you're all very welcome. And my name is Ola Bajekadjuri, if you forget that. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of art in social action and activism. And it has long been demonstrated as a tool to create visibility, encourage conversation, and stimulate change. And we're going to be talking about politics as well, because that is very much the heart of a lot of these beautiful documentaries that we're going to be seeing today. And there's going to be a focus on the marriage equality and abortion rights campaign in the Republic and in Northern Ireland. And our activists and filmmakers who are also involved in these campaigns will be discussing how recent referendum victory. And there's going to be a focus on the marriage equality and abortion rights campaign in the Republic and in Northern Ireland, and our activists and filmmakers who are also involved in these campaigns will be discussing how recent referendum victories in the Republic have an impact on the films and here in Northern Ireland as well. And we're going to be talking about documentary as a medium for social change. So first of all, we're going to look at my short film, What Does Artists Look Like? I made it last year, and it premiered at the Westport Literary Festival, and it's about 6 minutes long, and I'm exploring the Irish identity and how identity is not fixed. So I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much. I hope you all enjoyed that, and we'll be extending this conversation to the audience as well. But I'd actually like to discuss with you, Tasha, if you could come up here, because this team that I was dealing with in my video was about belonging and about identity, and of course that extends to us all on the panel in the films we've made. But this whole issue of like duality, like that's something I really experienced myself, you know, being Irish, being Nigerian, and like the kind of conflict between the two, you know, the clash between having two cultures. And Tressa, you deal with a lot of themes of belonging, duality, and migration and travellers. Could you talk more about your work and why you're passionate about these issues?
Hi everyone. Excellent film. Thank you for making it. I made a film that was shown at the festival last night called Town of Strangers. And it's a film that, because I made a lot of more directly activist films before, and this film that I made recently, I sort of took a different approach. So it's kind of a meta film. I went to this town of Gort in Galway, which is like a very small town in the west of Ireland, that has quite a high proportion of non-native Irish people living in it. So a lot of, especially Brazilian people who have come over to work there. But there's lots of different kinds of people living there. But the people who came to the audition, they ended up making a film. And I would the words that I use, nothing is quite right when it comes to identity, especially when you're naming other people besides yourself. But I try to say people living between hybrid cultures, because I guess it's kind of more non-binary rather than saying they're this or that or they're both these things and so on. The people I was sort of attracted to and worked with were, there was like a teenage traveller girl who was born in the town, but would be identifying with two ethnicities, if you like, or two cultures. There was a couple of Brazilian migrants that were living in the town for quite a while, an Afghan man, Syrian woman, and then some English self-identified hippies that had come like 30 years or more before. So I was kind of interested in this kind of idea of hybrid cultures, and without sort of, I suppose in some ways I could have made more vox pop type film with them, but I asked people to tell me their dreams, lives, memories, and gossip, and went into kind of more imagination. the way we tell stories about ourselves to ourselves. I think identity is very bound up in that. And I was also interested, rather than, I think sometimes there's a lot of rhetoric about like integration, and I was kind of interested in the longing, or the kind of the being bringing together two cultures, but also being torn between two cultures. So for example, one of the characters in the film is undocumented, and her father dies in Brazil, but she can't go to the funeral, so she mourns him on Facebook. So those kind of, I suppose, sometimes I say the film is about belonging and longing, and that sort of yearning or mix of things, if you like. So I suppose, yeah, this was kind of a very different approach to maybe, but obviously identity is a huge part of the film, but it's not like, I never ask anybody, tell me about your identity, tell me about your journey here, or anything directly like that. It was more about...
And you mentioned integration there, how sometimes we kind of overdo it in a sense. Do you feel like in a lot of, maybe not films per se, but a lot of like campaigns or things like that, we kind of try to push diversity, like for example, there'd be like one black person in an advert. Do you think we're always trying to make something diversified rather than inclusive?
Well, I suppose there's lots of different people making different things, so it's like, but I suppose in a lot of mainstream culture, I suppose, yeah, you could be kind of bent on that type of stuff, yeah, or tokenism and so on. I guess, I mean, you're probably much more sensitive to that than I am in many ways. I'm kind of more sensitive in many ways to, I suppose, representations of women and so on as well. So yeah, I think there is tokenism and so on. I don't have a token man on this panel, actually. But, please, of course. Yeah. But then there's also very direct, very good kind of portrayals as well.
So we're going to watch your film now, Eat Your Children, the trailer and Exposure.
This is not the film that I'm talking about, so you know. This is a film I made, which is more directly an activist film. So it's more about activism in Ireland. There's some stuff in it around identity and what Irishness is about, and post-colonialism, etc. And then the other film is a one-minute full film that I made with a refugee that I met in Korea's Court. So I made a series of small shorts that I made them with people about the event.
Ireland is a terribly strange country. I'll always say it's a really weird place.
Office and retail space available. Where? I mean, is this what we're talking about?
Yeah. And I also remember everybody telling us, you've got to buy, you've got to buy, you've got to buy. You were crazy if you didn't buy, crazy if you didn't buy.
There's a narrative here, there's a story being told, and that story is a lie.
They're chanting, "This is Greece, not Ireland. We the workers will resist." It's nearly brave, the bad weather here in Athens hasn't dampened the revolutionary fervour.
Like, Queen to London in the last 6 years have to protest.
Have you protest? What do you do to start a protest?
Thank you. the gospel reading I've been using today is about the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan is an outcast, somebody not understood.
For that, that was the Eat Your Children trailer. And now we'll just carry on introducing our panel. Anna Rogers, you're very welcome. A lot of your work deals with love and sexuality. Can you talk to us more about why you choose to deal with those themes in your films?
I suppose we're just driven to tell good stories and important stories, and in the last kind of 10 years or so, obviously marriage equality was a huge issue in Ireland, and personally, I felt very passionately about it, and I didn't really stop to think about why am I doing this as such. It was just something that was really important, and in 2008-2009, myself and Aoife Kelleher made Growing Up Gay for RTÉ. Which it just seems so crazy that it was not that long ago, but it was the first time that teenagers had spoken about being gay and lesbian and transgender. At the time, I couldn't find a young person who was transgender to speak openly and show their face. And I remember we spoke to a commissioning editor in RTÉ afterwards with kind of a follow-up idea, because we were really driven to do something further, and they said, we've ticked the gay box. And that just said to me, I'm not going to stop here, so we just looked for any opportunity to kind of, increase visibility. And visibility and telling your own story became incredibly important in the lead up to the marriage equality referendum, and subsequently the repeal the 8th referendum, as we saw it, people telling their own stories, ultimately changed the law. So I think it was, Somebody to Love was another film I made, and it was also about a law that prevents people with disabilities from having relationships and having sexual relationships. So I suppose it was just trying to find ways to influence politics and influence law by just that very simple thing of getting people to share their stories.
And a lot of your work has to do with pre-marriage equality in Ireland. How did you go about exploring those themes in your films? Because this was pre-marriage equality, so Ireland, I feel, wasn't as open.
Yeah, people were incredibly willing, though, at the same time, to get involved, although there was a nervousness that, say, there probably wouldn't be now. Certainly with the clip you're going to see now was from a film called Novena, and probably it was the only film that I made that I felt incredibly nervous about as well, because, there was no funding for the film, I had no backup of any organisation. We put all our own money into it, and I should say, the community and people kind of rallied around us afterwards and kind of did a really successful funded campaign. So that felt really amazing, and that gave me the balls, I suppose, to go ahead with the broadcast. But I remember the morning of the broadcast getting a phone call from RTÉ to say that I had to sign an indemnity. And it was post that time when, if you remember the whole panty thing where the big panty gate and that big payout had happened, and I thought, oh my god, if I have to pay out something like this, if somebody takes issue with this, and I didn't have any release forms for people who were in the church that day, and I was getting kind of very warning kind of signals from our solicitor. But people were nervous to tell their stories, but at the same time people felt this was really important and we have to do it. So Stephen, who talks at the Mass, was in a Novena Mass in Dundalk, and Father Michael Cusack invited himself and Kay Farrisher to come and speak just very, honestly about their experience growing up gay and lesbian in Ireland without a Novena. And it had never happened before. I think, it was a brave move on his part, and the two of us, kind of ended up sharing like quite a few phone calls where like he was nervous, obviously, because what was the church reaction was going to be? So that was a much bigger worry, but we really bonded over that. And I was asked to edit the film into something that was maybe more of a balanced. I couldn't see how it could have been changed. I never really fully went down the road of exploring it. I was offered a better time slot if I edited into a different version. I suppose I won't go into too much detail, but I said no when I was told it would go out after midnight on a kind of short schedule. And I said, well, it's a really good story, so it's your decision at the end of the day.
I was watching it last night.
And it went out, I think, at 10:05, so we still got a good enough time slot, so I'm glad we didn't change it. It was 2013 that we shot it, 2014 that it went out. So, all these little things that happened all contribute in some way to the public consciousness, I think, so like people like Kay and Stephen, who wouldn't be people who, would be like grabbing the limelight and looking for attention at all. They're both feeling a little bit reluctant to do it and nervous about doing it. But they definitely, all those people who came forward and showed their faces and told their stories definitely helped that vote, I think, in 2015.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about it further because I love the film. I watched it last night and we're going to watch it now, actually. So, yeah, we'll
just. A little clip just from their speech, I think, yeah.
The gospel reading I've been using today is about the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan is an outcast, somebody not understood, somebody not accepted. And Jesus gives an example that the one who cares is from outside. So therefore, look at the example of these people that you've already excluded from your thinking.
My name is Kay. I am legally married to another woman under South African law, and a civil partner under Irish law. I could be your sister, your daughter, your teacher, even your mother.
My name is Stephen. I'm civilly partnered under Irish law, and I too am happy and fulfilled at this stage of my life. I could be your son, your brother, your neighbour, or your work colleague.
I grew up in a small island Catholic community. The church was right at the centre of our lives. In national school, our day started with morning prayers, Angelus at 12, followed by the half-hour catechism up to lunchtime. When I moved to secondary school, religious instruction changed. We read the Old Testament and the documents from Vatican II. I particularly loved the Psalms and the verse from Isaiah. I have called you by name, you are mine.
I can remember that we learned a lot about the many different types of sins, which meant there was always something to tell in confession, even as a young boy. However, in secondary school, I realised that I was becoming attracted to other boys. I discovered what a crush was, because now I could feel it, just like everybody else can. It was very frightening and hard to understand, but it was clear that it was much safer to keep it to myself and to be very careful not to let others see it.
As a teenager in the 70s, I was aware of the abhorrence of homosexuality, but I knew that meant men. What about women? This invisibility of women made me afraid I was some type of freak. In all of this time, I had never met a gay person, or so I thought. Yet today, I now know of three women I grew up with who are gay. I sensed something in them that I wasn't able to sense in myself. Something in them that I was too terrified to allow surface in me. A difference that felt like it would shatter how I knew myself and cast me outside family and friends and the church.
As a teenager, I felt very low inside in how I valued myself. And sometimes I felt like I did not want to live.
When I met a woman who I wanted to spend my life with, and realized that the physical expression of our love made us sinners in the eyes of Catholic doctrine, I had to leave. How could something... But it was like the song says, the wind beneath my wings, the realization of my lost soul, be seen as a sin. And it is ultimately this, the need to be true to who we are, to let our light shine, that transcends the fear of being judged or of being an outsider.
Television documentaries, but the film that you'll see at the end of this is something that was funded by Northern Screen, actually, so it's not with the broadcaster, and that was on purpose, to be honest.
And that's Equal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a film about equal marriage, so, and for similar reasons, I actually sort of decided to do the film and not have a broadcaster on board, because I didn't want them to tell me that I had to balance the film, because I'm not sure how you balance a gay person with a non-gay person, or somebody else's point of view, you know? So, yes, that's a little show at the end of the talk.
Yeah, that's very interesting, that topic you brought up there about balance. And I was asked to balance a documentary idea I had, and I thought it was very odd because the documentary I wanted to make was about like people of colour in Belfast, and I was asked by a broadcaster to balance that. And I thought it was very odd because it was literally just about existence. Yeah. And just showing that these people exist, and it didn't make sense in what way to balance. I think they wanted me to go to like white nationalists, like supremacists, and talk to them, but they get enough media coverage these days in our political current political climate. So a question I have for you all is, the films you have are films with a social message, and sometimes films with a social message get pushbacks at times. And for me, with my film, I got a lot of trolls commenting and negativity, racist comments, and saying like, oh, how can these people be Irish, and just all sorts of rubbish like that. But I just want to know, have any of you received any pushbacks on your films? Like, Anna, did you receive any pushback on Navina?
As in online? No, like, I mean, that was the only thing that happened, I suppose, was around that piece of, of reversioning it, which, I suppose, there were other reasons for that. It was probably around, kind of, drawing a bigger audience, but, like, we didn't get any backlash online or anything like that. But, I suppose the biggest thing that is an obstacle to telling those stories is that kind of accusation of something not being balanced or of being worthy. That word worthy can kind of sometimes get in the way of things being commissioned, or I suppose if people feel like you're telling a story like that from just one perspective, especially if there's anything political happening around that topic, that the broadcasters can become quite nervous around.
I think it's the idea of worthiness, and then also this idea of campaigning broadcasters, and people don't want to, because they feel if maybe they're have a film that has a campaigning type message, that they somehow are then involved with that message, so then it can shut down a lot of things, perhaps, sometimes. It can shut down sort of that documenting, that's where we're meant to document the issue, and document the campaign, but then it sort of, it gets into that, where people get scared of worthiness.
Yeah, and who is the person telling the story, what's their agenda, and instead of, I suppose, as well, looking at balance across a schedule, the balance doesn't have to be, I suppose, in every programme or in every film, but that, in how you kind of curate or
programme, your slate of projects and productions, that balance can come in other ways, you know, so it's a very rigid framework to apply.
Yeah, and I find that balance has more to do with journalism rather than documentaries. You know, documentary is an art form, so I don't feel that it necessarily has to have this balance, so to speak. Trasa, have you faced any pushback?
I think balance is bullshit, if you don't want to say. I mean, it's kind of used as, because it's not balance. I mean, you're often, especially with, all the stuff with human rights issues. So to probably balance that as such with, you know, people who are against human rights or against those things. And especially when you're working with people, you're not working with issues, you're working with people who are affected by those things, and that can be very traumatizing to like be telling your story and then have to be balanced by someone who doesn't respect you. I don't think that's balanced at all. I experienced with Eat Your Children, with the film board, it was too left wing and they wanted balance, but I was like, that's the point. It's an alternative trip through Irish history from a left-wing perspective. But so, and I guess that's it. You know, so like that was kind of the, yeah. So I got that from a different side. And then one of the characters in the film in the trailer, there was like troll comments underneath about her that were really sexist.
Yeah. So I deleted them and reported the comments, they were gone. Yeah. But it was like really shocking for me because she trusted me with her story.
Yeah, and I think it can be difficult at times in social media reporting things, because I know for my documentary I tried to report them all, but like sometimes some of these social media networks, they don't take them down immediately. And I remember on YouTube, my documentary's up on YouTube, and there was about 1,000 dislikes and like about 80 comments underneath, and just saying loads of racist stuff, and I had to just block it all because they kept going and going and going. So it can be hard sometimes because these issues are so important, but we're always going to have these oppositions out there trying to push us back, but it's important to keep going and keep producing that art. And do you see the content in your films as issue-driven filmmaking in the wider landscape of documentaries? And why is it important for you to make these films, Jillian?
To be honest, whenever I was asked to do this panel, my first answer was, but I'm not an activist. Like, you know, like that's, I don't see myself as that, and I don't see myself. I made Equal because, well, two reasons. I'd done a different film for BBC Northern Ireland called Out of the Shadows, which was about decriminalisation of homosexuality in Northern Ireland and telling that story. And then I'd actually wanted to make Northern Ireland's big gay epic, was actually the hope, but that didn't happen, sadly. And but maybe one day will. And so instead, then I kind of just I made Equal because I was really pissed off, basically, because I'm a gay woman who wanted to get married and I couldn't, and I can't still to this day. Although my wife is in the audience there, although we are married in the South and in countries that accept our marriage, we're not Northern Ireland, and I think I felt like I needed to do something or say something about it. And if I, as a documentary filmmaker, if I make other people's stories, I sort of thought, I very reluctantly came around to the idea that I had to sort of tell my own. And as much as I can go to the marches and do certain things that way, I thought I should probably just make a film. And it took me a long time. And I didn't really want to put my own story in it, to be honest, because I thought it was really egotistical and terrible. But then I realised I couldn't expect everyone else to tell me theirs, not tell my own. So that's the reason I made Equal, because I was really pissed off.
Yeah.
And I still am.
And being from Belfast and with Northern politics, how do you kind of bring about the issue of like no marriage equality here, no abortion rights? How important is it for you to explore these topics in your films?
Yeah, I think it's really important, and I think what I would like to say is, for example, like Northern Ireland Spring are very brave and very supportive of Equal, and to be honest, at one point I was a bit scared. I was, because, well, I knew I wasn't going to do the balance thing, and I got worried that they might panic, that their name was going to be at the start of a film that they think was too campaigning or too, but they've been incredibly supportive. And I think because they realise that they have to be part of that conversation And I know obviously with abortion, you know, there's talk of, like it's happening in America, of, oh, don't make your films here because North Ireland doesn't have abortion, and I can see the point of that, but then I think if we as filmmakers from North Ireland can highlight the issues, you know, then...
Yeah. Do you feel like it's you have to do it then? Like,
yeah, I guess so, yeah. There's an element, yeah, where I feel it has to be done. I mean, I don't know if it's going to... You make films and then you go, well, what's it going to change? And I don't know, I didn't make the film and thinking that it's going to... that it's going to change the law, but I do think that, like, I've had to pick... Equal has only just been finished this year, so it's, and it's not online yet, it's going to go to a few festivals, but so far the comments I've got from it, I think people respond to people were very honest in it, you know, and I think, which wasn't easy for a lot of people from Northern Ireland, because although we are wonderful campaigners in many ways, because we have to be, and we like to march for things, and also just march, and I think people were really scared, like, for example, I had a couple that was going to be in Equal, and they were really reticent about doing it, because although they're out to their family, they were like, oh crap, but then you're going to put us into this audience, and then everyone's going to know that we're gay. And then they plucked up the courage and they said they would be filmed. And then what happened was they got married in America, and then they decided that they wanted to adopt a child and start that process. And basically then people said, you cannot be in a film about equal marriage, because they were like, what if you don't get a baby? What if it became the, and so they are not in the film because they were worried that they would be seen as activists and campaigners, even though all they were gonna do was just tell their story of the fact that they are in love and they are married. But you know, there was this reticence of, I guess, although we are very good at shouting for what we want, people are scared of being maybe putting their head above the parapet in a way of saying.
And that's actually a question, another question I have. How do you get your interviewees to trust you to take on their story and to explore it in the best way possible you can? How do you get them to do that, Anna?
I mean, you know, we always go meet them obviously in person and talk it through. I mean, you know, you mentioned the thing about the comments online. We usually warn people of sometimes like the worst case scenario, just so that they thought through, you know, what it would mean them to be in a documentary and for it to be so public, because you don't know when you put it out there what the public reaction is going to be, and especially growing up gay, say I know I would have had a lot of very long conversations with them because they were very young, and with their parents as well, and we had psychologists involved too behind the scenes, so there's a lot of things went on, like Belong To provided a huge amount of support to the young people. As I said, a psychologist would have met them, and that wasn't in any way to undermine their decision-making or anything, but just because they were so young, and it was a big piece of media. But we also always try to show it to people in advance, and I know sometimes broadcasters and sometimes producers, executive producers, depending on the production company, can be quite nervous about that. And I never really understand that, because like I feel very strongly about that someone should see it, their own story, and how it's been represented and how it's been edited before it's shown to the public. It just seems so obvious to me that should be edited, even just, you know, courtesy and respect. And I think that always helps people, because they so rarely ask to change things, and when people do ask you to change things, they're usually really like small things, like, I really don't like my hands in that shot. Like, literally, that's like, we had that in growing gay, when one of the young men said that, and we were like, oh, okay. But you know, it's usually something so small, or maybe something you wouldn't have thought of. But just offering that opportunity, that moment together, we watch it and they reflect on it and they're prepared, and they can emotionally and mentally prepare themselves for what's going to be shared. It's just so important. And isn't it better to have somebody freak out in advance if they're going to, than afterwards, which could kind of backfire on everybody? Reputationally, you know, wouldn't be good for the broadcaster or the filmmaker. So, personally, that's my main thing, I suppose, in terms of getting the trust. And then, after a while, when you've made a few things, you know, people know that by looking at your work that you're probably not going to let them down, and that can help too. But it's a big deal.
And speaking about hands, I watched your film Hold On Tight, and that was very much centered around couples holding hands. I thought that was very powerful. How did you think of that idea?
Well,
Well, I was actually dating a woman at the time. I wouldn't hold hands with her in public. And it was a bone of contention in our relationship. And so that's where the idea came from. And then I talked to lots of other people and realised, you know, that was my first relationship with a woman, so it was kind of just a new thing, and I had my own issues around it. But when I talked to people who had been out since they were like teenagers and they, you know, had lots of relationships and they still weren't showing affection in public, I thought, God, that's really quite a big topic for people. And often I met couples where one person really, really wanted to show their love in public and the other person didn't, and it was a source of conflict. So that inspired me to make it. And again, since referendum, you just see people holding hands so much more, and it's really lovely. Like, and always when I see that, I'm kind of reminded of the film. So it's a nice, it's nice. But you know, you see that there was two women attacked on I think it was in a tube in London,
yeah.
Just recently. And so, you know, these issues, they don't go away.
Yeah.
Just as
so
the
does
law
that helps you push more to make more films about, you know, relationships and love and how,
yeah,
love is political, but it shouldn't be love is love.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done, I have two babies, so I have been very, very busy with other kinds of productions, but I haven't really made any LGBT stories since the referendum. And it's funny when something changes like that, and it was such a huge source of kind of inspiration to work towards that. But I suppose, you know, people's stories don't go away, and representation remains really, really important. So, you know, I'm always constantly thinking about it and looking at the different ways that stories can be told. They don't always have to be about changing laws, and they don't always have to be about such big issues. But yeah, I suppose, yeah, I've had a bit of a hiatus, that's why.
And Tressa, I want to go back to you about the issue of getting interviewees to trust you to tell their stories. How do you go about that?
Yeah, I think it's a big thing I think about a lot. In the small kind of short, I should say, it wasn't small. In the short films that I made with refugees when I was in Greece, when I went there, I worked in solidarity camps, and I was actually going, I'm not making a film. There's loads of media attention on this whole thing already, and I'm not going to add. There's nothing I can add to that as a newcomer and a white European to that thing, but I can do things in terms of solidarity camps and all that. So I actually was there for like 2 or 3 months, and I actually met a young woman called Noor at the port one day. I went for a cigarette to look out at the port, and the ship's leaving. At that time, people were getting papers in about 3 days, and it was before the 23rd of March when the law changed, or the policy, I should say, wasn't the law. And she was a 19-year-old Syrian woman who was travelling with extended family. And we started talking and so on, and she told me about her life and where she was trying to go, and we just had this lovely chat, and she was upset, I'm working at a solidarity camp, and blah, 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 and I brought her down for a meal, and we just hit it off as very much kind of contemporaries, I suppose. And I said, oh yeah, I also make films back home and so on. And she was saying, why aren't you making films here? It's so important, you should be making them. And I was like, oh, I thought about this, I'm not quite one. And I said, how about you? What about you? So we ended up anyway, in the next couple of hours before she got the ferry, making this film together. So I said, what would you like to make? What would you do? And I'll film it. So we made this film together. And that sort of, because she had wanted to do that, it sort of encouraged me in some way that it wasn't about not making films, it was about how to do it and how to approach it and how to work with people and not to get anybody to you in your film. And I suppose in that situation, there's a lot of filming of people where there isn't permission. And you know, I saw so many pictures of human beings with the word refugee on their way to Greece and then the name of the photographer. So they wanted permission, they didn't even start to say what's your name or, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's something I thought about a lot in those films. And then Muslim, in the 1 minute piece that we saw, that I was doing another project that I went back a third time for. I met Muslim and he was saying, oh, what's kind of camera is that and so on, and he turned out he was a photographer from Iran, and we started talking, it was night time, so we started talking about long exposure photography, which I know very little about. I did it years ago, so I was asking him, well, how do you do that again? So we went off around through export doing long exposure photography, and then that next evening we met again and chatted, and we came up with this idea of doing this Spanish piece. So that was again kind of made together, and there was other activists, people put it in, people that are still in the film. So I also felt like it wasn't even fully my film, so it's a film about five of us.
Yeah.
I put down.
And there is some
often I find in Irish media there isn't a lot of representation of migrants. How important then is it to you to put your work out there and make sure your voices are being heard?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important. I guess in terms of Chamber Strangers, the film I made, which isn't a directly activist film, but it's very much, you know, it's like, I guess I put a load of thought into representation, and my technique of getting people to be in my film for that one was to do auditions, because I actually had been in the town for the whole summer trying to kind of meet people and ask them to be in the film, and people sort of said yes, and then said, oh, I don't know, and so on, and I felt kind of icky about trying to convince anyone, so I said, I'm going to hold auditions, anyone who wants to come is just going to come. And so I said, so as well as asking for dream ties, memories and lots of, I put on a poster, all languages, genders, nationalities welcome. Mm-hmm. And I made it in Portuguese and Spanish as well as English. So that was kind of my way of, and then, so people who came to those editions obviously wanted to be in them. So it was kind of there from the get-go. So they were kind of two strategies, I suppose, I kind of used. So I'm still learning, to be honest. And I think it's a huge privilege and an honor and a responsibility to represent.
Yeah, of course, representation is very important, and it's key to social change. And I was wondering, is there any special fundings or grants that filmmakers can apply for in making an activist documentary?
There are funds, although I've never received money from them, but there are social justice funds. There's like, in America we do quite a lot of it, and I think, I suppose, was it the Doc Society thing yesterday, they're talking about climate change, you know, and I think, and actually somebody made a really important point of saying we don't always have to make, say, climate change films, but if you're making a documentary about, I don't know, like another subject, maybe throw in a question about climate change, do you know what I mean? Make it, just thread it into your story, you know, which I actually thought was a really interesting point. But yeah, there are funds, and I think it's, I suppose there are funds, and I think that's then interesting, because it's that thing of the documentary, I suppose, should be about activism. Have you ever got money from? Tell me how.
You're crazy. Because there's definitely like foundations and things like that, but I think they're very difficult and very competitive to access. And in the US, you know, you're up against probably quite a lot of people, but yeah, I've never, you know, things are funded, like the Hold on Time is funded by gays, LGBT film festival in Dublin. So, you know, there's just funds that are, that you can access, or, you know, funding was great for Novena, that's how we wouldn't have been able to make it, but actual specific funds.
People feel like, oh, well, we did that one, we did that 2 years ago, so
no
more.
And that's quite chilling in a way, because, you know, I know I have since pitched a couple of LGBT-related subjects, and, we're very much told, you know, that story's been told now. I was told, this is really bad, I don't think it's going to be from more tea, but anyway, this is true, but somebody from more tea told me that the story of Yes, which was our document of the referendum, was a reheated microwave dinner. So that was lovely. So we had
on the poster.
Thanks, you know, for that. It's nominated for an IFTA. You don't get a reception to now. I mean, you know, in some ways it can be great when people say, look, why don't we just be inclusive? As you said, it's not about diversity or maybe telling those specific stories anymore, maybe it's about inclusion, and then maybe you just have a lesbian character or a gay character in, a drama just written in there, and not a big deal made of it, or maybe, you know, when it comes to those doer-upper programs about houses, you just throw in, you know, your lesbian couple are doing up their house, whatever. But the problem is that unless people maybe specifically
think and care about that topic of representation and inclusion, things just start to slip then, and it's so easy for people to start to become minorities and invisible again. So, like, you know, things just go off the table, and, you know, that concerns me, you know, like, that if you don't have people out there, you know, trying to make these films, trying to make films that, you know, because nobody turns around and says, like, you know, we've ticked the straight box, or gone past, that we've had way too many straight stories, you know? So, yeah, it's frustrating, and especially when there are, like, you know, still lots of stories out there to tell, and lots of problems. So, yeah.
I think also it's this kind of, you know, having, you know, representation is important to kind of pull through everything, but it also is a kind of assimilation as well, which is kind of, you know, the kind of feminism that's like add women and stir, rather than systemic change through feminism, because, so like it's add women to politics, but you don't change politics, rather than politics itself needs to change in order for women to be part of it, which is the other way of just turning it around, I suppose.
And a lot of, you know, I can't speak to this, but I have heard a lot of people say that they felt during the marriage referendum that, you know, a lot of voices were kind of quietened, or, you know, like that people were kind of told not to show their outrageous, whatever, like their kind of wilder side, or what, you know, their you know, not to tell their stories because they didn't fit into a certain paradigm that was like safe and palatable for, you know, Mary in Galway, or John up in Donegal, or whatever, or, you know, that people felt hidden away. And so, like, only a certain type of stories were told, you know, that some people felt were maybe, I suppose, a very limited kind of view of what it meant to be LGBTQI in Ireland, you know. So, yeah, so people were frustrated, and I heard that there was a discussion that, you know, really interesting discussion we had at Gates, like, a year later. So, like, there's still lots of other kind of stories out there to tell, you know.
I felt that somewhat. I mean, as much as I did, I campaigned as well. So I understood why we had to do that, but I also felt a bit staying on is like the party line a little bit.
Yeah, the same. Yeah, that's not like door to door. I was actually told by somebody, don't say you're bisexual, don't tell anyone that.
That's very clear. Yeah. Gay, happy, and want to like the defense of marriage just like you. So that was problematic in some ways, I felt. Because what I would like to do is have a campaign for single people to get the same tax benefits as married people, rather than for gays to join the institution of gender identity, if you like. So, but at the same time, I understood it was more than that, and it was actually, there was such, there was also so much, and I felt this big change that was against the church. It wasn't, you know, wasn't what we were asked to tick on that ballot box, but there was like such a, I felt like there was a social shift, and there was all these conversations and understanding. So it was mixed feelings of the great mood versus the complexities weren't really there as well. But maybe there are the stories that we need to tell now that the law has changed.
I'm kind of jealous that you guys got to tell a story and have the happy ending. It's really hard to actually make a documentary or something that's still going, and I'm like, well, what point do I stop? And I was very naive actually, and when I asked my parents to fund this film, very naively thought that the law would have changed by now. And I kept delaying it and delaying the film, as Christine will attest to. And then eventually I was like, oh, great, I'll just have to have this ending then. What do you think?
You need to make a follow-up film.
Well, yeah. More money.
I just want to go back to the topic of balance again. I don't know if you watched the documentary on RTE a while ago, and it was about transgender people, and they had Brendan Gillian, who's transphobic. That's very dangerous.
I didn't watch it because I was asked to boycott it, so I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I don't see it either, but like, I wonder, and I think they didn't tell people who were inclusion that he was going to be in it, from what I understand, but I could be wrong on that, but I saw something on Twitter to that effect.
It would be to be a film about this balance thing, some sort of satire, you know.
Yeah, but that, I suppose that's that whole thing of like, you know, how do you, you know, and it became a bit ludicrous like that in the lead up to the referendum, because, you know, you're looking for, you know, that other voice, but that other voice, you know, is sometimes really extreme, and maybe their views aren't, that isn't, you know, the opposite of somebody telling their own personal life story. So you have these kind of really bizarre scenarios where you would have somebody on the radio who's telling their heartfelt story about their own life and their kind of raw and vulnerable and going out there on national radio, and then you'd have somebody like, you know, from Iona up against them on the panel. It just seemed to be a strange way of approaching things.
I think we're running out of time now, so I'd like to take some questions from the audience if anyone has any questions.
We're living in an era of social media where their people's ability to sort of make and their visual impression of their life is available to them a lot more, and that for some people that's been really useful. For perhaps minority groups or ones that often don't have that visibility. But what role do you think that documentaries and art form has to play within that context where everybody kind of has their own smartphone and can present their own lives?
This is a question, yeah. I think I often compare this to you know, this idea that we have the technology and so on available to us and YouTube and so on. But the pen was invented a few hundred years ago, but it doesn't make everybody a good writer, I would say. So it's actually, there's a craft and a skill and an experience in terms of being an author of any kind of cultural form. So we have talked about issues, I suppose, but I could see my work, not all of it, because sometimes I separate more activist work from my filmmaking, but they're mixed, they're non-binary too. I think that being authors of your films is different necessarily than doing something to the camera for your Facebook, which is important for activism but not necessarily for filmmaking.
The other thing that's true, and yeah, it's very annoying when people kind of say, there's nothing where people say, I want to do that, or I can do that. But the truth is, as well, that I'd never discourage somebody who wants to make a film, they've never made one before, because, you know, sometimes, like, somebody makes their first film and it, like, wins at South by Southwest, and, you know, so you can't underestimate either, like, somebody's ability to tell a story even with no experience. So, like, in a way, the democratization of it, you know, with the availability of, like, you know, tech and phones and things like that, you know, allows film to happen that would never happen otherwise. So that's brilliant. So, like, you know, sometimes you do get people coming to you for advice, and that's happened on a couple of occasions where it's been their first time, and, you know, give them a bit of advice and they've kind of disappeared off, and then I've seen their film exploding on, like, you know, literally one of them was Vessel, the film that won the South by Southwest and did amazingly well. It was a sister of a girl they used to live with, and I was like, oh my god, you know, because I had seen a little bit of early footage and she'd never made a film before, and there you go, it's just, you know, did incredibly well. So, and I think, you know, that's great that you can pick up a camera and tell a story at the same time. But it doesn't always
work. I think the one amazing thing that's going to be for the next generation of filmmakers, or say 10 to 20 years, the archive is going to be incredible, because people have filmed themselves so much.
Yeah.
You know, like now, whenever when you pitch a story, say, like I was pitching a story recently, and commissioners often ask, well, is there archive often? Is there to tell the story? It's such a big thing. So the one, if people are putting all their stuff on social media, it's going to be a gold mine for filmmakers in 10 years.
But still, like Joshua was saying, it doesn't necessarily mean that, because I often find it so disheartening when you go looking for footage of this really, like even, you know, recent events, you know, really recent major events, and there's so little of quality documentation of important moments. Like, obviously, the news cameras are always there, but they'll get their shots and leave, you know, but they're not looking for the same type of footage as a documentary might be. And it's kind of rare enough that you'll find something and go, oh, thank God, you know, that footage exists. So even though there's loads of cameras at, like, major moments sometimes, just actually somebody who's out there capturing it in that kind of artistic way, or really got another eye on it, you know, where they're looking for the emotion or the story behind what's happening, that footage is hard, much, much harder to find.
Yeah, and I just thought of it now, about censorship, and, you know, if you have a mobile phone and you're trying to maybe capture an incident on the street, how much right do we have to take our phones and capture that image or that, make that video, do you think?
What's happening on the street?
Well, I think a while ago there was an accident on M50, and yeah, there was someone like taking a video of that.
Yeah, I remember hearing the whole conversation. Yeah. There's a name for it, Robert Eckend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, I don't know. I mean, I have some crowd scenes and things in my films that I don't have individual rights for. And like, you know, in each children I filmed with Electric Picnic, with crowds and stuff, but every individual that's kind of doing piece of camera, there's like a conversation, a release form, and all that stuff. So yeah, I guess I kind of go by crowd scenes is okay, and if you're kind of identified, and obviously this, if you see somebody that might be having an affair or something, and especially if you're undocumented, or even if you're not, yeah. So even with crowds like that, it would be a witch, or you know what I mean, because you just don't know where. So there's a lot to think.
Yeah, so it's context, isn't it? Like, yeah. You know, you're thinking about context and the sensitivity around it, or, you know, sometimes like lines can be crossed as well, or, you know, just like public interest, you know, that whole kind of the interest, the public might be interested in watching it, but, you know, is it in public interest? You know, officially, you know, because that sometimes can dictate whether or not you can kind of cross some of those lines. It's important to know. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of, like I don't know. You have a moral compass about it, like it's a common decency thing. Like in that incident, you know, just upsetting to the family. So like, you know, you'd always be kind of questioning whether or not this is going to be hurtful or cause problems for people afterwards. You know.
Yeah, I was just saying, I suppose it's that what Alex just said, it's that always reminding yourself that when you hold a camera and put it, people you wield quite a lot of power, actually, because although people are very clued in these days, but I think you just, yeah, you have to realise that, you know, you kind of put people in a situation that they maybe feel that they're supposed to respond to you, do you know, so I suppose it's just realising and knowing when you're doing it for good and not for bad, hopefully.
There's legalities in this moral compass, because, yeah, sorry, I've just been thinking there, like, I filmed police and not got their permission, and they are, of course, individuals who are in uniform, but when they're at work, being that, they're also part of the system, so they haven't asked their permission, and, like, activist protests or things like that as well, like, I was involved in Occupy London, I was filming, I had a conversation with, like, a police man from me behind the camera, and I didn't ask permission, I put that out on video, so I don't have his permission. I don't have his knock permission. I filmed him and chatted to him. I didn't tell him that I was going to put that out. But is that? But I thought that was, it was a conversation where he was saying that maybe they would work to rule the police, and that maybe they actually, he didn't use the word solidarity, but he was kind of saying that he had to be there and so on. So it's kind of an interesting portrayal of someone.
I take quite a lot of pride in getting thrown off places actually for filming. I quite enjoy it.
But also, I love
when security comes to tell you.
Yeah, security. I filmed in Palestine as well, and I got permission from everybody except the soldiers, and there's just a whole series of soldiers trying to get me to stop filming. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like it's which is in the yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I have like there's my moral compass and yours.
It's kind of black and white sometimes, yeah. Depends, yeah. Any more questions?
I'd like to ask about, we've got a couple of questions here, but one about the Janine talk about not being an actor, not quite where he's at the beginning, but one last question about when you put your personal story in, you know, it represents something of what you're striving for, that you put yourself out in the limelight. I know probably something that really works for Samuel in the Night, which is a first-time filmmaker, but like you said, you know, glad to make this incredible film in Syria, but it's interesting, she set out that she was really, you know, in a war zone, and her normal everyday life, trying to get messages out, but it doesn't matter when you put yourself personally in the line of something that is, you know, is something that you feel that made you angry. Like, how do you feel about exposing that yourself, your family, your wife, your whatever it is? You know, how do you feel?
Yeah, I think I was very reluctant. It was the editor I worked with, a really great editor, Shan Rutledge, who I had myself in the film, but very much, much less than I am. And I think it was her that just sort of gradually worked on me and was like, you need to put your voice in this a bit more. And I guess I was worried for two things. I was worried personally in case people would respond badly to it. And I suppose on the other hand as well, I was worried that then I would box myself into being the gay filmmaker who's just constantly banging on about gay shit. So like, I think that was my worry, that I would get pigeonholed, I suppose. But yeah, I think actually my worry is actually was more maybe my parents, who actually still haven't seen the film. And maybe that's interesting, I haven't shown it to them because maybe I am nervous about what they will think about it. Because although it's not bad, it's like it's still, it's exposing, and it's weird to think that your life just simply because I'm married to a woman, that somehow makes me have to feel exposed to people's hate or ridicule, or you know, it's yeah. So I suppose it was the first, I haven't put myself in a film ever before, and yeah, it does, you feel a little vulnerable actually. Yeah.
Films, but I put myself in at the very end of the editing process in both of them. So my next film, I just said, okay, I'm going to so my next film is about motherhoods. I'm saying in plural because it's not always used in plural. I think there's various diverse versions of it. But I feel very like, oh shit, like I don't want to put myself in it, but I have to put myself in it because that's what's driving me and so on. But it's also like the pigeonholing. Oh, the female filmmaker who makes a film about motherhood. Or, and also like my baby will grow up and maybe watch it someday. Like you're like, oh no, how embarrassing. And like, I feel like all this kind of, you know, all these things, and the pigeonholing is a big thing as well. And you feel that, but then it's like, it's almost because of that, I'm like, well, then I definitely want to make it anyway. Yeah, it's like you.
I know, and it's crap that you have to feel that way. Just, you know, it's really because there are filmmakers who make films, brilliant films about war, you know, and like the other director for Sama, you know, and so. They don't get pigeonholed for, you know, they're, you know, it's sort of held up, but I suppose when it's these issues or things that people see, and then yeah, it feels weird, it feels like, yeah, you could be pigeonholed. Or,
I almost feel like it has something to do with our identity as well. Like, I feel like a straight white male won't have to be pigeonholed making films, so.
That definitely happened to me, and I, like, you know, but it's very nebulous, and it's very hard to put your finger on it, but like I've had things said to me by a commissioning editor saying, you know, I have a problem with you editorially, or, you know, using the word worthy around my work. It's all kind of, it's very like in a low level, but yeah, you know, I just wonder, do other people get asked, or is that said to other filmmakers in the same way? You know, is it because I've made things that were, you know, on that side of the story, I suppose. And that didn't happen before. Like, that didn't happen 3-4 years ago. Those words were never used in pitching sessions, or, you know, yeah, there's a bit, you know, I won't go into too much detail. It's obviously, there's still the only people that, like, fund a lot of my work, you know, so you have to be careful. But yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. But, like, there's definitely conversations, and I kind of hear things that have been said back by other people and things, and you kind of realise that this, on some level, is operating a conversation about you and your ability to tell a story in a kind of, you know, unbiased way. And like, nothing really is completely unbiased. Like, you know, there's always decisions being made, it's always, you know, an author or a storyteller, even though like there's an eradication of that in the kind of the way that documentaries are broadcast, and you know, there very rarely do you have filmmakers whose voice is kind of there in such a kind of present way, unless they're an on-screen author, you know. And that whole kind of idea of authorship now is kind of used in a way to describe a presenter rather than a filmmaker. So like, you know, Ortiz will refer to author docs, but they're actually talking about a presenter who's being directed to somebody who's invisible. Which I just hear this stuff.
Like, the reason we're drawn to certain subjects, and I mean subjects in terms of themes and people, is because we feel maybe empathy with them because of our own experiences, and that gives us sort of insight that's kind of very special, and empathy, solidarity, that kind of gives us a very unique place from which to make the film.
It's what, like, the way everyone has talked about, it's making people feel like it's collaborative, that yes, you're the person that goes into the edit with all the footage, but that they know what's happening and what you plan to do with it, and absolutely showing people the work as well. And I think it's really weird because you're like, sort of, I had somebody recently after I did an interview with them, and they were like, oh my God, that was better than a therapy session. and it's like, I was like, oh shit, are we okay? Are you alright? Are we okay? Are we good? And I think that is weird because people, and sometimes in, it's about relationships and it's longevity, and I always try and put on my budgets a lot to stretch them, so that the more time you spend with people, the more comfortable they're going to feel. I suppose I took a gay man to France purely so he would tell me a story about holding hands for the first time, and it's really weird. We went for 5 days just so I could get this story on holiday in France. But it was really weird. We cried a lot. The two of us cried a lot for 5 days. There was a lot of tears shed. And I think it was, he trusted me because he saw I was responding, and he had never told this story really to many people. And when people feel that they're listened to, actually, that's when I think you get the best from them.
I feel really bad now because I don't really talk to them that much beforehand.
Never taken a man to France.
I tend to try and avoid having big conversations in advance. Like, obviously, you know, talk about what I'm going to do, and you know, tell them the truth, and you know, inform them as much as possible. But I try to hold back on having conversations about their story in advance, because so we have that conversation for the first time on camera. So like, that can be kind of hard. We sometimes go, don't tell me. And really, that comes down to having an amazing producer. Like, so if you have a really good researcher or a really good producer, they go out and have that much bigger kind of conversation with them. So then it's all about, I suppose, putting them at ease, you know, in terms of the atmosphere, that you just are really reassuring and make sure you have a really nice crew and there's a lovely atmosphere, and you make people feel really, really comfortable and safe, and they, you know, they understand why you're doing it and what it's for and all of those things, and they're informed. But ultimately, I try to make sure that that story is captured for the first time when they're telling me for the first time. But yeah, they usually have talked to somebody else on the team beforehand in some way. So if I don't have somebody working on that, then it gets really, really complicated, but it doesn't always work out.
Yeah, I think it can be hard sometimes, like, as a filmmaker, maintaining that like relationship and professionality with an interviewee.
Yeah,
so now we're going to screen Gillian's film, Equal.
Do you
want to
talk about this?
What will I say? I was told just you have a really good log line. So the log line for this is, a battle for love, a battle to be equal.